Item number 16, so we're into moose, from cougar to moose. Mooses. Dr. Harris.
Good afternoon, members of the commission. Rich Harris, I'm the section manager for moose and later for bighorns and goats. And we're running a bit late, but if I remember my Einstein correctly, if I talk really close to the speed of light, we can make time slow down. So if I speak too quickly, just slow me down.
Watch his finger. That's what he said.
If I speak too quickly, slow me down. I'll try to make it brief, but I do want to give you a bit of an introduction to the situation that I think we're at with moose right now, because that's important background to get to the regulatory changes that we'll be proposing. Just an overview of where we currently hunt moose in the state. There are moose in other places than this, but this is the core of our moose range, and where we'll be talking about regulatory changes that take effect. As most of you know, moose in northeastern Washington increased dramatically over the past few decades. I think we are now to the point where we can fairly confidently say that that's no longer the case. They've either plateaued or begun to decline. In most cases, when I say something like that, you would ask me to show you survey data that supports that, and I don't actually have it. And the reason is that we actually don't have surveys techniques that are capable of providing that kind of information with precision on a time scale of 3 or 4 years. It takes many years to be confident that a trend that you see from the kind of counts we're able to do are reliable. However, we do have this demographic study in two study areas north of Spokane, from which we've been getting a lot of really valuable data about how our moose are doing. We started that in December of 2013. So we're now on slightly more than 4 years of data. And that is really telling us a lot more than just counts of moose, how they're faring. And so this, do I have a pointer here? Maybe not, yeah. These blue lines outline the approximate areas of the study area, and all these little polygons show you where we have cow moose. This has all been done with female moose wearing GPS radio collars. So I want to show you a little bit of the data from this, but when I do that, I want to give you the caveat that all of these data are yet to be fully analyzed and published. This will be happening in the next year or two, but it's been 4 years, and it's enough for me to give you kind of a snapshot of what we're learning. One of the things we're learning is that calf survival is on the low side, and that's particularly true in the northern study area. The northern one is the one that has wolf packs. It has a higher density of cougars and higher density of bears. This is not unexpected. I'm going to put a caveat on that, which is that we don't know for certain that predators have killed any of these calves, because the way the study is designed, we can't follow the calves per se. We can only know approximately when they've died, and we know a lot about the cows, but not so much about the calves. That said, it's likely that some, or perhaps most, and perhaps even all, of the mortality we're seeing in calves, particularly in the northern study area, is due to predators. We also, this slide's a little bit out of order, but I'll have to go with it. We have another source of data that we've begun to ramp up in the last few years, and that is citizen science, people telling us when they're out in the field about moose that they see. We're not using this as an index to moose density. It's not reliable in that sense. Our primary use for it is to get a sense of how many calves they're seeing per cow that they see, because that's less likely to be biased by observational patterns than anything else we can come up with. That's an adjunct to our own work, and we find that very useful. And we'll be using that further as we continue to build models of what we think is happening with the moose population. So I do want to give a plug to that. And for those of you who live and recreate and work in the northeast part of the state, continue to help out. That information is very useful to us. We are actually using it. This is an indication of where recreationist hunters, skiers, hikers, etc., did report observations of moose to us during the September through November period of last year, which is the snapshot in time that we're wanting to use this information. We'll continue to keep this program going for the next few years. We've also been able to determine pregnancy rates, not only of the animals that we captured, but by following, understanding where they are in the winter, we can find out if they're pregnant, even in years we didn't capture them, from collecting their fecal pellets, and we can find fecal progesterone indications of pregnancy among female moose. And one of the interesting things we found here is that pregnancy rates in our moose are really low, and that's particularly true in the northern study area. It's not too great in the southern study area either. And this is a really interesting finding, because if you believe what I was alluding to you earlier, that we might have a fair amount of predation in our northern study area moose, you would normally expect pregnancy rates to be higher, not lower. Because typically a species that's under a lot of predation pressure is at lower density, is responding by having lots of pregnancy, and we actually have lower pregnancy in our northern study area. And that's a very interesting finding. When it comes to survival of the adults, which is the single most influential factor in population dynamics, interestingly, the northern and study and southern study areas have, our point estimate is that they're identical. Obviously, the point estimate is not the only way we judge this. But we see no difference in the survival rates. That said, they're both a little on the low side, not terribly low, but we're seeing a bit lower survival of our adults than I would hope we would. But the causes of mortality among adults differ. In the northern study area, these are all very small numbers because we only have a total of about 70 moose we've been able to follow over the few years of this study. So not many of them, most of them are still alive. We have been able to determine the cause of mortality on almost all of our adults due to the hard work of a lot of people in the field, including some in this room. So among the northern mortality areas, the one that you might want to look at first is this purple one, wolf predation. As you can see, it's here. So there have been a few killed by wolves, but we've had some by infection, some unhealth, and even more due to ticks. And the reason we know it's ticks and not wolves is that the animals are whole when we get to them. They haven't been eaten or opened up at all by predators. In contrast, the southern study area, no wolf mortalities. Of course, we don't have wolf packs there. Hunter harvest has been the primary cause of adult female moose mortality in the southern study area and a few other assortments. So it's interesting that in the north, while we do see some effects of predators, we're seeing other kinds of reasons for mortality among our adults besides predators. So getting to where this means in terms of regulation, I think what we are seeing is the beginning of a slope downward in our moose population, and I think it's because moose face numerous difficulties. And the primary, if you had to summarize to a single cause of the problems that moose face, it's themselves. Moose density is very high relative to its long-term capability to support. So with the population is almost certainly declining. If you put all those numbers together and work out the expected population of growth, it's negative, it's no longer positive. So what do we do in a situation like that? Well, the other part of it is we still have quite a few moose. We have our paper of estimating moose populations in all of Northwest Washington is about to be accepted by the Journal of Wildlife Management, so I'm more confident than I was a year ago when we spoke in Spokane about our numbers, and I think we really do have quite a few moose. That said, probably fewer and fewer as years go by. Normally, we'd be looking at a wholesale reduction in permits. I actually don't think we want to do that. I think that, again, the long-term future of moose in Northeast Washington is going to be fewer than we've had for the past few years, regardless of what happens with predators. And I think that hunting is actually a relatively minor influence on the ultimate density that moose will attain in Northeast Washington. It's part of the picture, but it's not driving the system. I think other things are driving the system. So, however, around Mount Spokane, we clearly have overdone it. And we know that because hunters are having more trouble finding moose around Mount Spokane. Our indices of calf, not so much the calf-cow, but we know that our mortality rate is too high among cows around Mount Spokane. So we're proposing to back off the cow harvest around Mount Spokane, cutting it by more than half. During our three-year package, we brought out the issue of what about youth hunts? And we've had youth hunts for antlerless moose. We have not had a youth hunts for antlered moose. And proposal from the department was supported by a majority, but not necessarily all by any means of the public, was that youth hunts are important, but moose is not necessarily the species you need to trot out for a youth right away. So we have proposed a pretty dramatic reduction of youth hunts, have other species continue to be the place where youth can get involved with species. It doesn't have to be the Cadillac of species for the first one. So that's where a lot of the reduction in the antlerless harvest we're proposing come from. That said, in other areas of the Northeast, particularly in District 1, we're proposing a very similar moose harvest as we've had over the past few years. Understanding the moose population may be declining, but allowing hunters to be part of that reduction until we get to the place where hunting is simply unsustainable. But we think that hunter opportunity is still available at this point. That said, we're moving from moose being almost ice cream, like we got so many moose we don't know what to do with it. Everybody goes out, gets one, and everybody gets a gigantic trophy, to more of similar to other species, whereas we expect that success rate may not always be north of 90%. We'll have to manage them a bit more closely as they decline. And also, we want to know at what point does that decline stop, and what's more likely to be an equilibrium number of moose. So we're going to have to increase our ability to monitor them. And so a couple of things we want to do is we want to increase our ability to get ages of harvested moose, because that's part of the information we can use to put into statistical models that help us understand the overall trajectory of moose. As it is now, we ask moose hunters to send us a tooth from moose. That's the way we get the age. And this is an example of the kind of modeling we can use that requires us to know the ages of moose harvested. Here's some data showing, this is a bit of a complicated graph, I'll run you through it. The blue, these are the years on the bottom from 2001 to 2016. The blue line is the trend of harvested moose over those years. And this largely reflects our regulatory changes. We made a big increase in the number of permits in, 2008, and it stayed relatively stable for a few years. And then we made another large increase in the number of permits available in 2015, and that's reflected here. The red line shows the proportion of hunters providing teeth for us to age. And as you can see, we got up around 85% in the early 2000s. And then we saw a general decline for a few years when we weren't getting as many teeth back from hunters. They weren't as excited about it. I increased our efforts in this year. I told all of our game biologists to call the hunters and remind them it was real important for us to get teeth. And we managed to get it up to about 75% again, or whatever this is. But it seems to be stuck there. So we are proposing to actually put in WAC, the requirement for hunters to send that tooth back. We give them a prepaid envelope. It's just a matter of them getting it back. We'd like to get that. We need all the teeth we can get because our sample size is right on the margin as it is. So that's one thing we've proposed, that submitting moose teeth, successful moose hunters must submit an incisor tooth, either in person or via the postage paid envelope no later than 60 days after harvest. We have not actually included a penalty for not doing so, but we're hoping that this is one more impetus for folks to actually do that. The other big change we're making is we're actually proposing doing away with the any moose hunt category and replacing that with antler bull moose. A lot of people don't even realize that we have this any and this antlerless, because most people who use the any moose are interested in a bull, and most are successful in harvesting a bull. But under any moose, it is legal to take a cow. And that means that we lose a little bit of predictability in what we're going to get back in the harvest. We don't know for sure if someone's going to shoot a bull or a cow. So we are proposing that when we give a bull permit, we'll be getting back a bull. The only exception to that would be, the regulation requires you to see an antler, so that would prohibit taking calves of the year as well. So it'll be more like a bull versus cow harvest. And we had a bit of opposition to that, but I think most hunters are fine with that distinction. They're used to it from most other species that they hunt. The way we'll accomplish that is it'll have to be a visible antler. If you've already accumulated points for the any moose, that will be transferred into your antler bull moose category. So you won't lose any points. And I think almost all the hunters who were putting in for an any moose were interested in a bull anyway, so they won't really lose anything there. There'll be no change to the antler lifts. The other thing, other change we're bringing to you with moose doesn't have to do so much with population trajectories as with logistics, and that is we've had this master hunt for moose in Region 1 for the past few years. Years ago, we used to offer 20 permits, then we dropped it to 10. In fact, we were using one or two a year. There really wasn't the opportunity. Enforcement in Region 1 came to us and said, you know, this is really not working out. In the odd situation, we have a moose that we might be able to use a master hunter on. We have to go through this list. It's a statewide list. The master hunter may be from the other side of the state. It's really the odd situation in which they've actually been able to use a local hunter who happens to be the next on the list. So enforcement has come to us and said this is so infrequently used that it's really more of a headache than it's useful. So we're proposing doing away with it. Once in a while, they have to dispatch moose. Once in a while, we move them. But the master hunt for moose has just not really lived up to its promise. So we're proposing to save us that headache. Last on the list for moose, although this actually could be put into any of my three species, and that's a proposal that we revise WAC 2412080, which has in it a hunter education. It's the permitting, the special permit WAC. As part of that, as you know, you have to take or pass hunter education unless you're grandfathered in. But there's a loophole. And because moose, goats, and sheep, we don't require hunters to buy their license unless they're lucky enough to be drawn. It's a two-stage process. Unlike an elk or a special deer permit, you buy the license and hope you're drawn. In moose, sheep, and goat, you only pay for a application fee, which is relatively modest, and then pay the larger fee only if you're one of the lucky ones to be drawn. We also have this situation that allows you to check a box and say, I am applying for this, but I don't actually want to do the hunt. I just want to accumulate the points. This has resulted in a situation in which people apply for a moose permit on behalf of their three-year-old. And we have kids who do not have hunter education, who could not actually hunt a moose, who are applying for moose permits to get the points so that when they are old enough to take hunter education and be part of the hunting community, they've already built up a number of points. We don't have a situation like this analogous for other species. Some people know about that system and they take advantage of it. Others don't know about that situation and their children are essentially disadvantaged because they start from the get-go. So it's a little bit of a loophole. We don't allow, for example, people who are 60 years old to start applying for over 65-year-old hunts and apply and get ghost points and think, aha, when I'm 65, I'll already have 25 points. And won't that work out well? You only get to apply for hunts that you can actually do. But this is a loophole where you can actually apply for hunts that you're too young to even take hunter education for. So we are proposing to do away with that loophole. For those folks who already have accumulated points, they would keep them. They'd be grandfathered in. But we would stop the ability to continue that into the future. We did receive some opposition to this from folks who've been doing it. So we may hear from some of them because they were hoping that they could continue to take advantage of it. But their points would still maintain, but we're proposing to stop that. So this is the reason for that proposal that we changed that part of the WAC. As you've already seen, we're proposing a drastic reduction in the number of youth hunts for moose anyway, so some of that would go by the wayside. Public comments. We did get some support for changing any moose antler boots. And then the most opposition we got had to do with the one I just mentioned, the youth hunters having to take hunter education and the reduction in youth hunts. We did have some opposition to that from people who were hoping to have their son or daughter take advantage of that. And, of course, unhappiness with predators we did hear about as well.
Thank you. Any mooses questions?
And Rich, I'm the last person on earth that would advocate for more government control, but as far as your tooth mandatory requirement, I couldn't agree with you more. because everything in this state, well, just like Nate and I was talking about at lunch, we have just as many elk hunters as we have elk in the state. So you know that it's going to have to be managed tighter as we go along. And this system, if you draw a moose tag, kill a moose, yes, you should be required. And I'd even put some teeth in it. So you got an attaboy from me on that one.
Thanks.
You have a...
It gets worse if you think about the fact that you're talking about a moose tooth.
Yeah. Right.
Well, he said he was thinking about not making a penalty, but I would put some teeth in the law.
Sort of a, I think, multifaceted question. So, elsewhere in moose land, the populations have been on the decline, and it's a continuing decline. It's not plateauing. Until you answer, as I listen to you, you sound like you're expecting that we've been sort of overpopulated, that you're expecting that we'll decline and plateau, that we will reach a stable population. One more part. One of the things that I've heard speculated contributing to the decline is the tick infestation. We're beginning to see that. So why do you think we would be different? We have been different than the rest of the range since we've had an increasing moose population. But as we begin our decline, why do you suspect that we'll plateau rather than be like the rest of moose world and just be in a continuous decline?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the reason moose are essentially moose can be a pioneer species. That's not to say that moose only live in early seral conditions, but they really are a species that's designed to follow the fires, follow the disturbance, and they have a tendency to overshoot because they don't know when to stop. Oh, we've reached our capacity to keep having babies until they start starving, and we're seeing starving moose out there. So when you have a pioneer, moose, remember, are newcomers to northeastern Washington. Places like Minnesota and Montana, even Montana, they're relative newcomers, but not nearly as new as us. So we're still, I think, seeing the end of the period of the colonization of moose of northeastern Washington. That's why I think we've had this dramatic increase, and I think we're going to see a decrease, which I'm hoping is not quite as dramatic. That said, I think the long term, there will be a lower density of moose, but it'll be something that will be sustainable. But correct, there's two things going on. That's one dynamic. The other dynamic is the long-term decline in habitat capability due to more ticks, which is generally associated with climate change, snow conditions being much more likely to be conducive to tick survival than we've had in the past. That's certainly one aspect. Habitat changes, the fact that we don't have as much seral condition, early seral shrub fields. The shrubs are really the bread and butter for moose. And as forests mature, there's something to eat in a mature forest, but not nearly as much as in that kind of heterogeneous condition of different seral stages. We're starting to lose that. Some more fires would be helpful, but as a state employee, I can't actually oppose fires. And fires can be damaging as well, but they're good for moose. So for now, right now, where we're actually seeing moose seemingly increase, although we can't really quantify it, is in Okanagan County, which has been on the edge. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the new pioneer location for moose. So I expect we'll see an increasing moose in Okanagan County for some years, and at some point that will probably level out as well. Mm-hmm. So in other places, it's more of a steady state. The other place where moose, the only places that moose were increasing in the western states in the last couple of decades have been northeast Washington and Colorado, where they were introduced. So that's also kind of like a pioneering. They're brand new, and so they're doing really well, and they won't do that well forever there either.
Yeah, Jay?
Well, I just got to get this picture out of my head. It's a ninja tick killing a moose. And I know that's not what happens. But is it disease, or is it really death by 1,000 tick bite?
Yeah, good question. No, it's not disease. These ticks are not carrying any particular pathogen. It's the combination of the blood loss themselves, and we're talking thousands and thousands of ticks on these animals, and the energetic costs of trying to get rid of them. And so the worst of all possible worlds is a mild winter where the tick population is high, followed by a severe winter when it's cold and the moose is energetically stressed and has lost some of its hair. And that could be affecting some of our calf mortality as well. Again, we haven't been able to follow the calves in the detail to really explain the cause of calf mortality, but in New England, they've done a good job of that. And boy, those poor calves are just dead before they have a chance. So yeah, that's an issue.
Okay. So we have one public comment, Don.
Thank you. I had so much fun commenting on everything else. I decided to comment on this too. I like the information he presented about the movement up in the population and now going down and that's what we observe too. When I was a kid, a moose was a real rarity, so it makes sense that they are colonizing. We have good habitat in Northeast Washington. One of the things that was pointed out to me that, you know, the increased number of pioneers, I guess you'd say, kind of coincided with the pressure from the wolf in Idaho and wherever the moose were there. I think moose got long legs, so they can find a new frontier fairly easy with that pressure. And, you know, we had high hopes for moose harvests. People that drew the tags years ago when I was a kid, there might have been two in our area, and now they're, you know, the permits were up to quite a few, and people got to look at a lot of moose before they picked one out to harvest. It sounds like that might be, you know, potentially diminishing depending on the population, but in our area, we'll call them citizen scientists again, that spend a lot of time up in the hills and in the snow and in the woods, find a lot of black hair in wolf scat. So I think moose are a preferred species for the wolf, even where there's lots of elk, where they don't eat a lot of elk. They'll eat all as many moose as they can, I think probably because it's a 10-on-1 fight. And our area doesn't have a big herd of elk that they pick off the limpers and gimpers off the edges. We have pretty good active bunches of elk that have 50 or 60 in a bunch, and they're more of a challenge for the wolves. So I guess I'm taking this opportunity to bash wolves a little bit, but I think they're having an impact on maybe accelerating that population stabilization or decline, whatever it turns out to be. I hope they stabilize and get healthy. There's nobody that's opposed to having moose or moose hunters or anything like that around in our area. So we feel like it's a good benefit to have in the whole region to have some moose permits. We just hope the wolf doesn't screw that up too. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I won't be able to be here tomorrow to bash wolves, so I have something else to do.
We could take a picture of you and blow it up and put it there.
Uh-huh.
Always a pleasure to see you.